welcome back. It's your favorite radio show. That's right. The Kaufman Show, Monday nights right here on TSN 690 Montreal.
And the calls are already coming in.
Already, my goodness. Well, it's because people turned it on in the last hour and thought that we were broadcasting live.
No, did they?
Possibly. I don't know. I had a couple of texts wondering what was going on.
I wasn't in studio when you were broadcasting it, so I was hoping we weren't getting any calls.
We figured it would be...
I'm saying, what are you talking about the lockout for?
we thought it would be more apropos to air the Gary Carter tribute from last year than to air the Leafs post-game show.
Yeah.
Although they won again, so good for them.
Who, the Leafs?
Yeah. Biting their way to a championship.
Good for them. Biting their way to the championship.
How are you, Jay?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm fantastic, man. It's been a really, really good week.
Yes.
And happy to be back on air. And you and I had a very interesting conversation tonight with Gary Carter's daughter.
Yes, we did. Yes.
And we're going to play it for you in a couple of minutes. But yeah, it was. And our thanks again to Rod Francis and to Mitch and everybody here at the station for allowing us to air that Carter show and sort of give a little bit of perspective to, you know, here we are a year later.
Already a year, huh?
It's unbelievable.
It's quick, man. Jeez.
I'm sitting there and I'm listening to that show for the first time since it aired. And one thing that really struck me was the story of you and I walking to the Bell Center for the Carter tribute. And Anakin Slade calls you and says, I'm going to be a few minutes late because he had to go tape an interview with CTV.
Yeah, what else is new?
Yeah. And I think you said to me, where should we meet my brother? And I looked at you, we're walking down like Drummond Street or something, and I look at you and you're head to toe in your Expo stuff, and without missing a beat, I said, well, we'll meet him on Pierre de Coubertin.
Yeah, a dead face, too. You were actually serious. And I said, well, why would we go all the way down there when we're already here? And you had no idea what I was talking about. And you said, I meant Gauchetier.
So our brain... everybody's brain that week was in a very different place, but here we are a year later, and it was an honor to speak with Kimmy, Gary Carter's daughter, tonight.
Yes,
and
very nice lady,
and I'll tell you, Jay, I have memories of her. We're the same age. We went to John Elias's baseball camp together.
Yeah,
and she was way better than all the boys back then.
Yeah, well, that's what she said. She grew up playing baseball, so she was quite the player.
Not
apparently.
A surprise that she went on to become an All-American at Florida State and is now the head coach at Palm Beach University's for their female softball team. Of course, the men's coach was Gary Carter.
Right.
So she got to go to work every day with her dad, which must have been pretty cool.
It was cool, yeah, if your dad's Gary Carter. I used to have to go to work every day with my dad, just not the same. His name's Gary, but not Carter.
Hi, Mr. Farrar.
Yeah, hi. Don't worry, he's not listening. He's watching Jon Stewart.
Jimmy, we're all queued up. Without any further ado, this is our conversation from earlier this evening with Kimmy Blomers Carter.
What's the last year been like for you?
It has been kind of an emotional roller coaster because I know that, you know, with life, I'm doing what Dad would want me to do and to move forward and to, you know, enjoy life and enjoy all the blessings that I've been given. So I've been doing that. I've been continuing to coach. I had my second baby girl, 6 months after Dad had passed, actually to the day. It was August 16th. Dad had passed February 16th. And, you know, there's been a lot of joy that has happened, just a lot of great things, but it's been sad not to have Dad with me and my family, different things that he can enjoy too. So it's been, it's hard. You know, I'm not with somebody who, you know, is around that I love very much and that supported me my whole life and somebody who I love to hang out with and spend time with. And that's my wonderful dad. So it's just been up and down. And it's just crazy to think that this Saturday is already going to be a year that he's been gone.
You guys were, you had a very special father-daughter relationship. It seemed that almost like a friendship more than your typical father-daughter relationship. Could you talk a bit about that?
Yes, when I was back in middle school, you know, those ages, I think all parents want to pass that age because that's the age where we feel like us middle schoolers know everything. And so we had that relationship where I was like, Dad, you don't know what you're talking about and things like that on the field, which obviously he knew. He knew very well how to coach. But I was just getting into fast pitch when I was 14. And so he started to coach me when fast pitch just came around. Like I said, I started at a very late age. I did the T-ball thing, slow pitch thing, but fast pitch wasn't until 14. And he had told me, you know, encouraged me to be a catcher. And that's where it all started. And I put his gear on and, you know, he taught me to be the catcher that I became and then encouraged me to also start coaching. And, you know, then we had that relationship there where, you know, he was the Palm Beach Atlantic baseball coach and I was the softball coach. And this is my seventh year this year. And this would have been Dad's fourth year. His third year, he was sick. And then, so he was able to coach for 2 years strong. But our relationship was very strong. I mean, it wasn't just about the game. I mean, it wasn't just about baseball and softball. That was definitely a very fun part of our relationship as far as just talking strategy and talking about the game and, you know, that kind of stuff. But it was also just that we loved each other, you know. I mean, there's three kids in the family. I'm one of three. And then, you know, of course, my mom. And so, I mean, our family in general are just extremely close and we just like to spend time together. And, you know, and when people tell me that, they remind me, I remind them of my dad. It's a very big compliment because I think my dad's great. So it's, you know, so we did. We had a very, very good relationship, one that I'll always treasure.
I imagine that it was your father's deep faith and devotion that allowed you to find that as well, right?
Oh, absolutely. My parents raised us in a Christian home. We went to church. We you know, we prayed together. We certainly weren't the perfect family, but there's no such thing as the perfect family. But yes, our everyday life centered around the Lord and our biblical foundation, and that was extremely important to us. And we still do that even in our own homes. I'm married now with two daughters, and my sister has her husband and her two sons, and then my brother just got married 4 days after Christmas, this past Christmas. And, you know, we're all starting our own families and continuing on those traditions. And that's something that we know that family and relationships together is having the Lord in our life. And so that's definitely been something that's been extremely important to us and that we will always carry on, you know, because that's just the number one thing that we consider very important for us.
Well, it was also something that I imagine helped you greatly through your dad's illness.
Absolutely. Well, I know that the world was able to read Caring Bridge. That was something that became such an amazing tool because the media and friends and family members all were able to read that and get updates weekly about dad's sickness and what was going on with us as a family. And you'll see on every single Caring Bridge site, every single entry that I wrote, there was verses that backed up how I felt and how our family felt and what we were going through and how we were getting through the struggles and through the storm that we were in. And so without a doubt, we are getting through what we're getting through, not only when Dad was sick, but now that he's gone, we are getting through it because of our faith in the Lord and because of our biblical foundations and because we know where Dad is and we know that with our relationship with the Lord that, you know, that we are going to see him again someday. And so we have that hope. And that's where Dad had pure peace from the moment he got sick. He had peace the entire time he was sick because he knew that if this fight was not going to be won, you know, one that we all were fighting for was for him to beat this, he knew where he would be and he would be called home to the Lord.
The Caring Bridge website is something that a lot of families use and find quite therapeutic. What was that process like for you, Kimmy?
Well, it all started off when my dad was first, when we first found the tumors down here in Florida. We knew that we were having to make a trip up to Duke. And at the time, I was able to be the only kid to go up there. And so I went up there with my mom and dad, and we ended up being up there for 11 days. But we went up there, and basically it was, you know, a way for me to, first of all, share it with first family and friends. So instead of people calling and texting and all that kind of stuff, we were dealing with so much that we figured, well, we'll go ahead and, you know, I'll go ahead and write on this website and then people can just log in. And then it became such a nationwide, even worldwide thing that we just let people have access, anybody to have access, because in the media, nobody bothered us. The whole 9 months that Dad was sick, we didn't get anybody to bother us or, you know, all the information that was out in the newspapers and out in the magazines and everything were all true because everybody quoted, you know, exactly what I wrote. And the experience was, I would say, very therapeutic because that's my major. I was an English major. That's something that I like to do is I like to write. I never thought that my type of writing would be, you know, publicly shown so much, but it became such a blessing for me. It became a blessing for my family, for my dad, because we were very real. We let everybody on the journey with us and let everybody to know what was going on and how to pray for us, how to pray for my dad. And 1,000%, those words were not mine. You know, not everybody is a believer, but I will tell you now that those were not my words. Those were completely Lord using me, and those were his words that he wanted to very much share with the world.
One of the things that you wrote, and I'm going to read a quote back to you from the final update that you wrote on the Caring Bridge website. Thank you for loving my dad and my entire family. I will still share with you all the last 4 weeks because they were incredibly special. What was that last month like?
Basically, what happened was is the moment that the doctor had come over, he told us that dad had, I think it was 3 to 5 weeks to live. And we were all told that in my parents' family room. And my dad's reaction was, well, that wasn't the news we wanted to hear. All calm like that. And he, you know, I don't think he knew where that state was, because he was very much, you know, very much getting closer to his time. But we, when I say it was a special last 4 weeks, I will say it was very difficult for dad. He never knew it was difficult, for the most part, because he wasn't 100% really aware of everything. There were days he was aware and other days he was not. But my brother had a big impact. He was physically able to help dad, because there weren't moments where dad could get up or, you know, walk or anything like that. And we had a night nurse come and stay with us to help dad. And, you know, so physically and emotionally, that part wasn't very fun to see, because dad had more than like a cough growing up. He was never sick or never hurt or anything like that. So that was definitely different for us to see. But it was, we just all rallied as a family, and we spent just extreme quality time together. And it was just something that we'll always treasure. It's, you know, specific details. I really, there's not like, you know, certain things that happen, that, you know, are just this big old story, except I know that February 8th was the last evening my dad was staying at my parents' house. And that was my parents' 37th wedding anniversary. And we ordered food from their favorite restaurant that they went to every year for their anniversary. And we ate it at home. And then we watched my wedding video, my sister's wedding video, my brother's, you know, birthday parties and different things that, sorry, that's my baby.
That's all right. That's great.
But, you know, just we just watched videos together and just, you know, laughed and cried and all that kind of stuff. But just really the last 4 weeks was just spending time together and just making dad as comfortable as possible, because it really was not an easy part of those last 4 weeks. And the details are tough to hear as far as what he had to go through, but never complained. And he was always, you know, very positive, and just, he, you know, allowed us to take care of him. And he had taken care of us for so many years in other ways. And this was our way to say, dad, we love you. And there's no way you're going to do this alone. And so, you know, that's kind of the sum of the 4 weeks that we had experienced. And then other things too, like his best friend from California came down, and then, you know, and other friends, and his brother came down, and, you know, and those, and we knew those were all the last times that they would see him. And so those were just other special moments, very tough moments, but special moments that, you know, wonderful people that love him were able to spend good time with him, you know, for the last time.
The final ball game that he attended at Palm Beach University, I know a lot of those photos were disseminated in the press, and that must have been an incredibly emotional moment.
Yeah, it was. He went there, and it was the most emotional thing, because we started off in left field, and he was sitting on a golf cart. The guys were getting ready for the game, and it was, you know, pregame, and they were, you know, kind of throwing the ball around and things like that, getting ready. And dad was in the golf cart, and he was riding from left field to right field. And all of a sudden, as he was about to approach right field, his players literally were dropping gloves, dropping balls, dropping bats, doing whatever it took to drop everything and run over to him. And so you see this entire team running over. And I remember, too, when dad was in the cart, as he was driving over, And again, this is 2 weeks before he passed, so he was not really, he was there, but a lot of him was also not 100%. But if you saw the look in his eyes as he saw that baseball field that he was riding on, it's like he was home. It was like you could just see this big smile on his face as he was on that park and on that field. And of course, he was very blown up from the medication and everything. But I tell you, here he is 2 weeks before he passes, and he knew every single player's name. He shook their hands. He said, "Go get them, boys, and go out with the big win." And they did. And then right before the game started, they put him on the golf cart again, and there was just a big standing ovation before the game started. So it was very emotional, and it's very hard to watch that video, but he was the happiest he had been by being out on that field. And interestingly enough, the very next day when he said, "Dad, wasn't that special?" he actually didn't even remember it. I mean, that's just kind of how his brain was. It was just moments where he was on his A game and knew people and knew what was going on, and then other moments where he didn't because of the tumors.
We're in conversation with Kimmy Blomers Carter on the Kaufman Show, Dave Kaufman and Jay Farrar.
Kimmy, as I'm sure you're well aware of, a lot of young boys in Montreal grew up idolizing your dad in the late 70s.
And girls, too.
And girls, too, yeah. And yeah. In the late 70s and early 80s, including my brother, who became a catcher just because of your dad. Later on, he was seen at your dad's last game here in Montreal holding a sign up, that famous sign behind him, while your dad listened to the national anthem. Later on, my brother became a kind of a music guy here in this city and did a tribute to your dad just recently. I was wondering if you heard it and what you thought. Anakin Slade, that's my brother.
Okay. Well, yes, I did. And I did not realize that that was your brother, but no, I know exactly who he is. And I mean, obviously through the internet, I've gotten to know him through his beautiful song that he wrote about my dad and that wonderful set of pictures and everything. And I think he also sang up there when my mom and brother went up to Canada.
That's right.
That's right. Yep.
Yeah, it was a special tribute up there too. No, it was beautiful. And I mean, gosh, all these tributes, you type in and you Google Gary Carter and YouTube, all these beautiful things come up and, and articles, and it's been overwhelming in a very positive way. And I'm just so incredibly grateful and thankful that I had a dad that just was so wonderful, that he was just such a nice person to other people, and he was so genuine, and that people want to talk about him and they want to be like him and they want to remember him. And gosh, I can't ask for a better dad that I got to have for my 32 years of life.
You got to share, or you were almost forced to share him with fans, with media, with so many people throughout your whole life. Was there a point growing up where that felt like a burden to you?
Well, there's actually a funny story. My mom and dad would tell me when I was little, I was very bold, and I guess I'm still that way now. I have that, very bold personality, but I guess we'd get dinner sometimes and different fans would come up, and I would very clearly say, "He's my dad. We're eating dinner," and that kind of stuff. I'd have no problem telling people, get out of the way. I'm with my family. But I mean, growing up though, what a fun lifestyle. I don't know any other way. But I mean, the fast pace and people banging on the car doors and "Gary, we love you," and all that stuff is a lot of fun. We had fan mail, and it's just a lot of fun to think about how many people idolize your dad. And of course there were moments where I'm like, okay, enough already, not baseball. Let's go play like a game of Monopoly and let's just, whatever. But we were just a very normal family. And I think actually normal, but yet abnormal in the celebrity world, because my parents were together. They were high school sweethearts. They were committed to each other. We had a strong love for the Lord. We were a great family, and we traveled everywhere together. We would leave about 2 months early from school every year, and we would finish our school wherever Dad was. And we supported him throughout his career. And, that kind of stuff I'll treasure forever. I mean, we were just very, very, very close to the family, and we still are. I mean, I know we don't have Dad, but if it wasn't for my mom and dad's first foundation and us learning about what true love is and what it takes to be a great family, I mean, you know, now we're able to instill that in our own family. And I'll just always treasure that and be forever grateful.
Kimmy, were you born in Montreal?
I was born in Montreal in 1980, October 6, 1980. And, yeah, that was Expo. So I'm the only Canadian. Well, I'm American, but, you know, I was born in Canada. Out of the three kids, I was the only one.
Now, you were obviously quite young when he was traded to the Mets, but you must have some memories of coming back here for your dad's final season.
Oh, yeah. That was, I want to say, 91 or 92. Yeah, I do remember it. We used to live in this, you know, cute place. Up, I don't even know where the specifics were, but, I mean, I just really liked it. I remember I was very much wanting to learn French, and, you know, the people are so kind up there, and you know, they do. I feel like my dad was like the god of Canada or something. I don't know what you want to call it, but he was very much loved. I should say it that way, that he was just the face of Canada. And that was really cool to be, you know, the daughter of somebody that people love so much. So I felt like I automatically, you know, had this wonderful family and an entire country, you know, because they loved my dad so much. So,
it must have been wild to see things like a billboard on the highway with your dad's face on it.
Oh, absolutely. But all growing up, though, you have to remember, like, you know, I even had like spiral notebooks and like folders with my dad on them. So I'd go to school and that's normal for me to have like, you know, lunch boxes of dad, or I'd have, you know, things like that. So, I mean, all that was, it's just how it was. But I mean, yeah, Canada, they didn't mess around. They loved Gary Carter, and it was very evident. And we felt loved. We felt very welcome. My mom will say over and over again, the 11 years were just unbelievable being part of the Expos. He loves those years.
The relationship felt very reciprocal, though. He always made an effort in this city and with the fans here, even just something as simple as trying to speak a few words of French.
He would go to a French teacher here in Florida, and he wanted to learn French, and he did that out of respect for being an Expo, and I remember that. And he knew the entire Canada, you know, I guess you guys call it national anthem, or do you call it what do you call it?
Yeah, it's our national anthem, O Canada.
Okay, O Canada, yeah, he knew that in French, and he very much wanted to be a part of whatever but this is how my personality is too, and I guess all of my whole family is, but if you are a part of something, you go 100%. If you want something, you go 100%. And that's how Dad was. He was a part of the Expo, so he wanted to be as much, you know, in that Canada world as possible. And so, yeah, he embraced it. He embraces that kind of stuff. And he loved being up there, you know, and he had great memories that he would share with us all the time.
I have a few questions about things that happened in your dad's career. I'm wondering if you could comment on his last game in Montreal.
I was 90. Well, I think it was 91 or 92. I'm trying to remember when he retired. Was it 93 when he retired or 92?
I think it was 92.
I think I was 11. When he was there, and I remember that very much. I remember the hit over Andre Dawson's head. I remember the big old, you know, fist pump at second base. I remember him being so fired up. And the joke was always, if Dad had a good game, we would go home with Dad. And then if Dad had a bad game, we would go home with Mom. It depended on who we went home with after the game. So I think we definitely went home with Dad after that game because he was pretty excited. But, no, it was – I mean, yeah, I totally remember that. I'm telling you, I remember, too, when we had the – when Dad retired and you guys had the amazing ceremony and we his number was retired. And we pulled that big banner down and – you know, we were all holding hands, walking from home to left field. And that was, I mean, well, if anybody saw a video of me, I was the one that was bawling my eyes out the whole time because I'm an all or nothing kind of person. I was pretty emotional. But, yeah, I mean, that's two memories for sure that I'll never forget. Very, very special.
The other one would be Cooperstown.
Yes, Cooperstown. But I was actually going to say one more thing as far as Canada. But I remember him get into the Canadian Baseball Hall of Fame. And that was another unbelievable thing. I mean, the crowd of people and the people that were just so respectful of my family and just so excited. I think I got a little extra attention because they knew that I was born in Canada. So I think out of the three kids, I got a little extra smile. But But yeah, but Cooperstown, I mean, my goodness, that was just, that was an unbelievable experience. The words that my dad said, I actually, since dad has passed, that's been giving me the most comfort is watching his Hall of Fame speech over and over again, because he was able to share, you know, in his words, words to me, words to my brother, words to my sister, words to my mom and friends and family. And I'm able to hear that over and over again, him telling me, I love you, kiddo. I'm proud of you. I'm, you know, all those things. And I knew that, but since I can't hear his voice anymore, now I can hear it, you know, anytime I want to on YouTube. But that was an amazing experience. Just, you know, I'm still in awe, actually, after this many years, that my dad's a Major League Baseball player, Baseball Hall of Famer, you know, the, one of the best catchers ever. And, you know, because I think it's so mind-boggling, because my dad was my dad, and he acted like an amazing dad and did not treat us, you know, that he was he was better than other people. He just, he was a genuine human being. And I think it just so mind boggles me that he, you know, did all that he did, and, you know, that he's considered famous, you know. It's just, it's still at this age, I still am like, oh yeah, dad was pretty awesome. Oh yeah, I forgot how much he did. So, yeah, but I mean, so many memories. I mean, I'll say over and over again that if it wasn't for my mom and dad, obviously I would not have the life that I have now. I mean, just for many, many reasons, but they together made this amazing team, and I'm blown away, and I'm incredibly blessed that I had Gary Carter as my dad, and then I'm continuing to have Sandy Carter as my mom.
The city of Montreal announced about 6 months ago that they'll be naming a street after your dad. It's a street that's adjacent to Jerry Park, where he first broke into the big leagues. Will your family be making it up for the for when the street is named for him?
Yes. Apparently, they haven't given us a date yet, but we told them that the first weekend of May works the best for us, but we still haven't heard confirmation. But if it is the first weekend of May, our whole family will be up there.
Well, that would
so
be,
we're hoping it's the first weekend of May, if anybody's listening to that.
Well, we'll see what strings we can pull. Finally, and I want to thank you again for your time tonight. We really, really appreciate it.
Yeah.
How will Gary Carter, the person, not the player, be remembered?
Well, from me, he'll be remembered as my dad, my amazing dad who loved me, who cared for me, who supported me, encouraged me, was one of my best cheerleaders when I was a player, a man of the Lord, loved Jesus, loved his wife, was committed to his family and his wife. And I don't know, I just can't say enough things about him. He's just, he's what anybody can imagine their, you know, hero could be like. That's what my dad is. My dad was. He lived his life genuinely. He was an honest man. He worked so, so, so hard, and it was all about family. It was all about, you know, what can I do for my family? And so I'm, you know, I could brag about him forever. He is my dad, but not everybody can say that about their dad. But I know for me, I could. I could talk about him forever, and I get very emotional thinking about, you know, that he's not here, but I know where he is, and I know that he's watching over me and my family. And you know, he's just remembered for so many great things, and he lived a life more than I think 10 people combined could have lived. And the things that he did for people and the community and the way he loved others, I mean, I'm thankful that I can remember him and then try every day to be more like him, you know, as I grow up.
It was fall 1998 at the rally. 3,000 Expos fans was the tally. Glad was there, Rusty gushed about Jerry, but I knew it couldn't be without talking to Gary. And I tell him all about the day 6 years prior, the night of his last game, the night kid retired. Had tickets in the bleachers, but I snuck down. Needed to say bye the only way I knew how. I told him I made a sign, spent all night drawing, and all I wanted was to make sure that he saw it. The slightest acknowledgement would have been worth the while, but I was thrilled when I got a thumbs up and a smile. We stood together singing the anthem loud, posed for the cameras, held my sign up proud. The next morning, Dad showed me the paper cover. There
was Gary, hand on heart, and me right above him. When I told kid the story, he smiled and asked my name and said he had that same pic at home in a frame. Today I got it hanging in my studio office. It's signed, God Bless You, the kid, Gary Carter.
Gary Carter.
Welcome back to the Kaufman Show. I hope you all enjoyed our interview with Kimmy Blomers Carter. That was really an honor that she chose to speak with us. And yeah, we will continue to keep
very candid too. Very candid, very truthful, and
most people are that come on our show
positive, okay? Positive energy coming out of her.
We're lucky that way. Most people that come on this show don't seem to BS us too much. We're very fortunate that the guests we have are always very open and honest, and here's one now. Let's bring in Anakin Slade. Hello, Anakin.
Good, because I got some things to tell you guys.
Yeah, you bring it.
I'm going to be truthful right now. No.
Spit truth.
I loved it. The truth is, I loved that interview. It was really it's tough because it's like you're reliving it again.
Yeah.
And I looked at the calendar. Probably about a week ago, and I thought to myself, you know, it must be about a year, because I remember obviously that it was in February, so I knew that the anniversary of his death was coming up. So yeah, and it's kind of like you're getting all those emotions back again, and of course, hearing Kimmy talk was you get it all back again, which is great in some regards and terrible in others, of course. Which I'm sure that's how probably she feels talking about her dad all the time.
Probably, and. I think the big difference, Anakin, is in the positivity towards the expos that has come out of the last year. And that's something that we didn't address with Kimmy.
Right.
But I think that's something that we can definitely talk about with you, that we've seen a huge difference in the way that the expos are looked at and looked upon, both in Montreal, in Canada, and North America. And a lot of that is because of what happened a year ago.
Yeah, you know, like, I remember Crow bringing that up at the event last year, the 81 event. And, mm-hmm. you know, I didn't even think about it until then, you know. But he was dead on when he said, you know, it's kind of like when you lose somebody, all these things come into perspective. And we, you know, we lost the franchise, and, you know, not too long after, we lost our greatest player and kind of the greatest ambassador to our team. So I think once that happened, people said to ourselves, wow, yeah, you know, like that's life. You know, there's a lot of loss, and you can't forget about those beautiful things that we had. And, you know, Carter is obviously a beautiful man, and you know, the Expos were a huge part of all our lives. So I think it puts it into perspective, and, you know, sometimes you need to get a kick in the ass to realize, you know, what you've lost and the treasures that you have in your life.
How are you, sir?
Oh God, I'm emotional now.
Well, that happens.
No, I'm good. I'm good. I'm out in the City of Angels, working on my next LP. So you know, in the grind, as they say.
Hmm.
But all good stuff. You know, I'm out here in Los Angeles for recording school. I'm recording at, and a couple of other wonderful venues where some classic albums were made, like Dr. Dre's Chronic. So I'm actually pretty lucky. I'm surrounded by some pretty great great people and mixing with some great people. So I can't complain.
Well, that's fantastic. It's wow, the Chronic was made. That's got to be very inspiring.
Yeah, and so L.A. too. You know,
I feel like this should have been a conversation last week when we had Ross Rebliati on.
Speaking of the Chronic, yeah,
heard that another truthful interview. Good job at that. And great one with Dick Pound too. That was a very riveting interview.
Hey, thanks, man. You can give full marks to your brother for arranging both of those interviews last week.
That's how I roll.
He's got the hookups. He's got his ear to the street. Man of the street, as they call him.
Yeah.
When are you back from L.A., Anakin?
I'm going to be here, you know, for a while. I mean, I don't have a set timetable, but we got to get this album done. And, I'll be back. You know, it's hard to miss a summer in Montreal, so I'm not planning to miss that anytime soon.
Well, I still have your Gary Carter jersey.
That's true. You have my jersey. I got my Dawson here in L.A.
My Dawson or your Dawson?
No, this is my dog. I got my own
dog. It better be. Yeah. I will kick your ass. You have no idea.
I know you will.
Anakin, we got to take a break because I don't think we have yet since the show started. But please don't be a stranger. And, God, get your ass back to Montreal.
Yeah, absolutely. And great interview. And, you know, like, I can't wait for May.
Thanks for calling in.
Again. All right, boys.
There he goes.
What's the deal with your dad? He don't even know my name. Didn't know he'd be back. Didn't know we'd been bad. No one stayed to share the blame. I didn't mean to do that. She won't even come around. Every time I look back, didn't realize that I was better off than now. Mothers came and cried forever. Brother Cain survived the centuries in. All the time that I thought was my friend, be all right till we get back again.
Our thanks to Kimmy Carter and to Anakin Slade. We'll be back in a few minutes on The Kaufman Show with Team Canada's John Mallow from the World Baseball Classic.
All right, and they won't never drag you down. And they won't never drag you down. And there ain't time to lose sight. There ain't time to lose sight.
Welcome back to the Kaufman Show. Dave Kaufman and Jay Farrar here with you. Our next guest's name is Jonathan Malot. He plays for Team Canada at the World Baseball Classic, which will be starting up in a couple of months in Arizona. Canada will be playing Italy, the Vendetta game, my friend Max and I call it. We can't wait for this to get started. And Jonathan is one of the big reasons that Canada is there. He was a stalwart for Team Canada over the last couple of seasons, and it's a great honor to have him on the show tonight. Hello, Jonathan.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm doing great. How about you?
Good. What are you doing to prepare for the tournament right now?
What do I do to prepare? I keep lifting and as much as I can. I try to go left and right and, you know, stay sharp, take some ground balls, hit in the cage. As we get closer, I'll try to face some pitchers. As we know in Canada, it's a little harder with the temperature to be able to practice on the field, so I'll have to do everything inside.
What's it like to try and stay sharp and play competitive baseball in the month of March?
Well, the advantage for the other guys is that they're going to be able to play outside and, you know, get some reps, face some pitchers. So that's what I'm going to try to do here. Unfortunately, as of right now, I don't have a major league team or minor league team to play with in early at the end of February before we get there. But, it's going to be a great experience to play with all those big league guys, and hopefully we'll do good with Canada.
You're a veritable veteran for Team Canada right now. First of all, 29 years old, which is, I'd imagine, one of the older players on the team. But you won two bronze medals, one in Natuno in 2009, one in Panama City last year, and then helped really propel Canada to the gold medal at the Pan Am Games in Guadalajara. I'd imagine that this has raised the expectations for you guys a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, the last few years we've had pretty good showing in all the international baseball competitions. So, you know, we have a good-looking team, so hopefully it's going to turn out good for us.
Are you feeling the pressure?
No, I don't think it's pressure, but, I mean, we like pressure anyways. We're used to playing in front of a lot of people, so it's a good thing. Usually most Canadians play good under pressure, so we should be okay with that.
You played in the Mets minor league system for a while. You played in places like Buffalo for the Bisons and are now playing for the Quebec Capitals. And I was wondering if you could sort of maybe explain to our audience the quality of baseball that you can see in Quebec City right now.
It's pretty good. I mean, it depends on every night. You know, some nights you're going to face some former major league pitchers, or, you know, it depends on the night that you what pitcher you face that night. But there's a bunch of guys that played in high minor league baseball. A few of them played major league baseball, so you'll have some good baseball there.
And I know you're from close to Montreal, but I guess this is the closest you can get to having a hometown team, right?
Yeah, pretty much. Well, there's a new team in that league now. It's in Three Rivers, but it's the same league. So, it should be nice to have a little rivalry growing between the two teams because they're just an hour apart.
Are you hoping that you're going to get another look from a major league team if you get a lot of playing time in the World Baseball Classic?
Well, hopefully, yeah. But, I mean, you can't think about that. You just got to, you know, play your game. And right now I'm just focusing to help Canada win. I'm not worried about getting a job anywhere.
Good answer. You grew up an Expos fan?
Absolutely.
So what's it like having Larry Walker and Denis Boucher in the dugout?
Well, it was my first year. It was pretty special. It's still special, but, you know, now that you know the guys, they're part of the family. It's just they're great guys, and it's fun to have them around and have the experience they have behind their belt.
I'd imagine that as a young Quebecois, the memories of Denis Boucher pitching at a full Olympic stadium must be something else.
I can only imagine what he went through. But yeah, it must have been a blast for him to pitch in Montreal. Being from here, it had to be great.
Now I got to take you back. When you first broke into the minor leagues, you won the championship. I think it was single A with the Mets, and your manager was Gary Carter, right?
Yep, in 2006 in the Florida State League.
What are some of your memories of the kid?
He's just a great man. I mean, he was asking a lot from his players, but if he played hard and came to the field every day ready to play, he was going to give you your chance. And he actually might be one of the reasons why I stuck around for so long. He gave me a chance to play a little more, and I got a chance to prove them a little bit what I could do.
That's very cool to hear. He meant a lot to so many of us, and it's nice to see that, you know, through the attachments with Carter or with Denis Boucher or even Larry Walker, that the Quebec baseball tradition does carry on and carry forward.
Oh, absolutely. There's still lot of baseball, good baseball players here, and I wouldn't be surprised if in the next few years we have more guys in the minor leagues and hopefully more guys in the big leagues too.
On a personal note, Jonathan, I have not been as down watching a baseball game since the Expos left as when Canada lost to Italy. Please, we got to redeem ourselves. We got to beat Italy, and then we got to take one of the other two teams and make it to that next round. We're going to be cheering for you guys real loud from here.
Absolutely, we're gonna be there, ready to go. We want to make it at least past the first round. I mean, this is we don't want 2009 to happen again. But you know, like I said, we're just a bunch of it's a good team, great team, and it's looking good. I think we're gonna have a good classic there.
One of the reasons that Canada has made it and qualified for the World Baseball Classic, Jonathan Mallow. Thank you so much for your time tonight.
Thank you.
Really appreciate it. The Vendetta game. I'm telling you, Jay, they have to beat Italy.
you know our baseball's in trouble.
If they don't, I'm going to bring Dave Bedini on and just yell at him.
Right. Yeah, I was just going to say, I mean, when our Vendetta's against Italy, that's, I don't know. We need to pick up, I guess, our baseball a little bit in this country.
Well, again, fingers crossed. And our thanks to John Mallow. We've been holding on to that one for a few weeks, so it was good to finally air it.
Thanks to John Mallow of the past.
Of the past, yes, and hopefully of the future. Hopefully we'll be hearing his name a lot and cheering him on at the World Baseball Classic, which starts in about a month's time. Bring it on. I can't wait. In the meantime, let's go to the phones, 514-790-1690, 1-866-896-2546. We're about 10 minutes away from Wendy Thurm from Fangraphs.com, but in the meantime, George in St. Lazare. Hello, George.
Hey, how's it going, Dave and Jay?
Good, man. How are you?
Not too bad, surviving this winter. I've never done so much shoveling in all my life. It's piled up here, let me tell you that.
Well, do what I do, George. Just wait for it to rain.
That's it. I was going to say put your kids to work, but...
yeah, right. Okay. Obviously, you're not aware of the new generation.
Oh, come on, George, you're Greek. It's all lawn mowing, gardening, and shoveling. That's all I did.
I'm part of that new generation, George.
Well, let me tell you something. It's kind of, I guess I'm expecting a lot from the new generation because we were put up to higher standards, I think, and morally and consciously, I think we were a little bit better, but I could be wrong. I may be proven wrong.
Every generation thinks that they're better than the new one, and then they're going to be saying the same thing to their kids, so you can't win.
I just wanted to share something with you guys.
Okay. Yeah.
Obviously, you know that I was a big Gary Carter fan and a very big Expo fan, right? And 2012 was definitely one of the worst years that I could possibly even imagine. It started off with Gary Carter passing away in February, and then during the year, I lost both my mom and my mother-in-law. So 2012 wasn't exactly an up year, but I did find comfort in when we got together with the Gary Carter tribute night at the pub there, and it was great to experience that with other Expo fans. And
that was a very cathartic evening.
It was a special night, and it meant a lot. And going to the Blue Jays game. And having that section there, that crazy section of Expo fans, yeah, that was a great thing, a great feeling and a great experience this year. So it added a little bit, you know, a little bit of comfort to the sting of losing the kid. And this afternoon, I just wanted to say something. This afternoon, I hooked up with Denny Brodeur, okay, and I tried to get Marty to come on the show, but obviously it's a hard thing to do. But I did secure something, and I just wanted your listeners to know this, is that when the Expos, when Gary Carter was given this tribute, obviously you can tell that I'm talking with a little bit of emotion and my voice is cracking, but when the Expos the Canadians paid tribute to Gary Carter, I think it was February the 20th against the New Jersey Devils, Martin Brodeur was, and the New Jersey Devils were visiting, and we found out the story about how prophetic Gary Carter had written while Marty and Denny were kids.
That's right.
About, you know, on their, wishing them success on their junior as future superstars.
Right.
And in the Gazette following the next day, they had a picture of Gary Carter on the ice with Martin Brodeur visibly had his head down and paying tribute to his childhood hero. And that was a picture that was in the Montreal Gazette. Now, the photographer of the Montreal Gazette gave a copy of that picture to the Brodeur family, okay? And what happened was that Marty Brodeur signed 8 copies of that picture, okay? And there's only 8 copies of it in existence. And Marty Brodeur has vowed that he would never sign that picture ever again. So obviously there's value in that picture, especially if you are a Gary Carter fan. Now, the first 2 pictures were auctioned, one of them on Marty Brodeur's official site.
That's right, and they went for a fair amount of money as well, if I remember correctly.
It was sold for $1,500.
Yeah, that's unbelievable, George. Sorry, we got to cut this a little bit short. We're past a news break right now. We're well behind on ads, but
can I continue after? I just want to say something so you all guys will know it, and I think it's important.
Sure, go ahead.
All right, I've secured a picture which Denny has donated. Okay, and we want to raise some money, and preferably to go to cancer research. So when you guys decide that you're going to do something special for Gary Carter or an expo night and you want to raise money for whatever cause like you guys did, just let me know and that picture will become available to you guys.
George, thank you so much.
Okay.
And for everything you've done in the last year, thank you. It's good. It's nice to know that an expo's fan calls into the show.
The spirit lives on. The spirit of the kid lives on.
Thank you, George. This is the Kaufman Show. John Kakalakis has a sports update for you. I hear the Leafs won. We'll be back. Welcome back to the Kaufman Show. Dave Kaufman and Jay Farrar here with you. About to bring in one of my favorite baseball writers. Her name is Wendy Thurm. You can find her stuff at Fangraphs, at Getting Blanked. She's got a new gig this week, which I'm looking forward to talking to her about. I saw her tweeting pictures of Tim Lincecum. Have you seen the new Tim Lincecum, Jay?
Did he get a haircut?
He did. He no longer looks like the kid from Dazed and Confused.
I thought he looked like the kid from Third Rock from the Sun. What's his name? Big actor now.
Joseph Gordon-Levitt.
Yeah, that's what I always thought he looked like.
Is that where you went with that, Wendy?
Well, that's what folks are saying now. Now with the short haircut, he looks like Joseph Gordon-Levitt. I didn't see him do a dance routine like Gordon-Levitt did in 500 Days of Summer, though.
That would be awesome, wouldn't it?
I can't speak to.
How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you guys?
Good, good. Nice to hear your voice. Thank you so much for joining us tonight.
My pleasure.
I reached out to you last week. You published an article. It feels like forever ago now, but I feel like it's important that we discuss it. And I want to explain to our audience that Wendy's not only a very talented baseball writer, but in her previous life was a lawyer.
Correct.
And I think that adds...
Life.
That's right.
This life, but, you know, a previous career.
Well, exactly. But you no longer practice law, correct?
That's true. I don't.
And I think I wrote on Facebook that that's for our benefit. It's their loss. It's our gain. But what it does is it gives a different perspective on the way that you discuss steroids from what I've seen from other baseball writers. And of course, this new story about the clinic in Miami, and a few weeks ago there were some names being bandied about. Of course, A-Rod was the biggest one. But then about a week later, it turned out that Ryan Braun's name was on one of the lists. And everybody pounced except for you. And I thought it was really fascinating. And I know it's because of your legal background.
Yeah, and I mean, and I would say, you know, I probably should have been a bit more active when the first story broke. A lot of folks were like, you know, oh, you're just defending Braun, and why weren't you out there saying this about the other folks? So, I mean, let me just take a step back. It was the New Times of Miami, or the Miami New Times, I'm not sure how they say their paper's name, you know, published the story several weeks ago. That weekly paper has obtained documents from an anonymous source that they say was at one point connected with this clinic in Miami called Biogenesis, and which I, from what we understand, is no longer in business. And the documents contain a variety of handwritten notations with names of certain baseball players, including, as was first reported, Alex Rodriguez, Gio Gonzalez of the Washington Nationals, was it Nelson Cruz?
Poor Nelly Cruz. It was Nelson Cruz.
Yeah, Nelson Cruz for the Rangers. Then last week, Yahoo Sports apparently has gotten their hands on some of the same documents, maybe even some additional documents that include additional handwritten notations with some other names, including Ryan Braun, Francisco Cervelli with the Yankees. I think there were a few of the names that I'm forgetting.
Danny Valencia was one.
Danny Valencia, right, of the Orioles. And some of the names apparently have are located on the same set of notes with names of substances that are prohibited under Major League Baseball's joint drug policy. Other baseball names have different notations next to them, or are silent as to either drugs or substances, and I think in some cases there's amounts owed or some references to cash. So, you know, in the first instance, you know, it's important to understand from a legal perspective, which, you know, Major League Baseball should be thinking about this, because to the extent that they want to be relying on these documents to potentially pursue suspensions for any of these players, that would be some, you know, that they're going to have to put together a pretty significant case, because other than, I guess, Melky Cabrera, whose name was mentioned, and was Colon's name on there? I don't remember. But several of the players whose names were mentioned had already been suspended,
right,
for failing a drug test or for turning up a positive drug test. And so the question arises as to what these documents are and how reliable they are, and what do they mean. I don't think that MLB will be faced with the same level of scrutiny in trying to proceed against players relying on these documents that you would in a court of law, at least in the United States. But we all should be asking the question, you know, whose handwriting is it? Who created the documents? What date or dates were the documents created? Are they a part of a larger set of files? You know, were they kept in the ordinary course of business? What might have been the motive of the person or persons who maintained the documents? You know, handwritten documents of this nature can be quite incriminating, as we've seen in the way that they've been described, which makes them, ironically, kind of the least reliable kind of evidence that you would have in
right.
a court of law, because they're so powerful and could be so prejudicial if not understood in a fuller context and not authenticated by, you know, the person or persons who created them. So that's kind of the first set of issues that you would want to think about from a legal perspective.
I find it interesting.
Then there was the issue of Braun's statement last week, and I can get into that if you want me to talk about that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And just before you do, the part that I find interesting and what really showed me that I feel like you have a leg up on this is that you used words like allegedly And most people didn't. And I find that to be a very interesting case. Not very often do you hear things like, you know, most people are saying it was the money that he owed, the 20 or 30 grand that Braun owed to this guy, Tony Bosch. You happen to throw in that word allegedly. And I think that that's really important when we're discussing legal matters.
You know, I think so, too. And, you know, when I was in practice, you know, obviously, I mean, not obviously, I dealt with in a variety of cases with some pretty high profile clients. And I was on the flip side of this issue where it was either, you know, newspaper reporters or, you know, PR people, a variety of people chasing a story that was related to a case I was working on. And, you know, on the lawyer side, you work to, you know, you try and work the press person to make sure that, you know, that your point of view comes across.
Right.
You know, here, I guess I would say that from what I've read, it seems to me that the New Times folks, and in particular the editor, who's actually said a bit on their website, in fact, about kind of their editorial process and, you know, kind of where, kind of how he thought about, you know, what should be published and what kind of information they felt they needed to have in order to go public with certain documents. They apparently had documents with Ryan Braun's name on them and didn't feel there was enough they either understood about them or that they could corroborate about what it would mean if you reported his name on those documents. You know, Yahoo made a different decision. Again, I haven't seen any of the documents. I don't know who the source is. You know, we don't know how reliable the source is. We don't know the source's connection to the clinic. We don't know what motive the source may have. So, you know, I give the New Times editor and editorial staff a lot of credit for actually being careful about this. Now, it's fair to say, Yahoo, when you read their stories, they do use the right words. They do say allegedly. They do say reportedly. But it's, you know, it's written in a more forceful way than I think the New Times story was originally.
So Braun has since responded.
Right. So the story on Yahoo Sports, which was the one that included Braun's name, it broke around 4 o'clock West Coast time last Tuesday. And a few hours later, he issued a statement. At least it was reported that was his statement and not a statement of his lawyer or an agent or another representative. And in the statement, he indicated that he first learned of Biogenesis and Tony Bosch, who was the guy who ran or was closely associated with the clinic.
Right.
And that Tony Bosch, he had become familiar with Tony Bosch through one of his lawyers who assisted him in appealing the positive drug test last winter, so in the winter of 2011-2012, and that one of his lawyers had used Bosch as a consultant in that appeal process, and that's what the notations in the documents Yahoo had obtained were referring to, including the reference to 20 to 30K, which was presumed to be a reference to $20,000 to $30,000 either owed or at issue between Braun and the clinic.
Right.
And Braun then went on to deny that he had any other interaction with Bosch and that he had, you know, come into his possession or taken any performance-enhancing drugs that had been obtained from Biogenesis.
Many people saw that, I think, and cried foul and said that seems preposterous. But then you chimed in. I know you went back and forth with Ken Rosenthal, the big baseball
right.
reporter. About that,
right.
Saying that this is something that actually happens.
Well, yes. And let me just add one more piece, which
sure.
is that before my story published, one of Ryan Braun's lawyers, and I think it's not the one who was initially connected with Bosch, issued a statement Wednesday morning early saying he didn't know much of Bosch. He first learned of Bosch when he became involved in Ryan Braun's appeal, that Bosch answered a few questions, but otherwise the lawyer, David Cornwell, had found Bosch to be, his information wasn't entirely useful. So the three pieces of information are the notes talk about the notes from that Yahoo reported on contain Ryan Braun's name, but they also contain the name of, I think it's Chris Lyons, Chris is his first name, who is one of the lawyers who represented Braun. The next morning, David Cornwell, a different lawyer who represents Braun, issues a statement, in a sense, distancing himself from Bosch and, it appears, from Lyons. And then kind of that whole set of facts is what I wrote about on Fangraphs. So, and what I basically said was Braun's story, even with Cornwell's, you know, kind of qualification on it, is entirely plausible. And the reason it's plausible is because Braun was careful to say that Bosch, the biogenesis guy, was used as a consultant, on his legal team. And lots and lots and lots of folks are used as consultants on legal teams in a variety of ways and in much different ways than experts, consultants might be used who are actually going to testify either through a declaration, a written declaration, or through live testimony. Particularly in a technical case like Braun's, where the issues get into kind of the science of kind of the handling, you know, of a drug protocol and the science of testosterone ratios, there are a variety of different kinds of folks that you would want to consult to kind of get the lay of the land, to learn, you know, about kind of what the state of the art is and how protocols have changed over time and why a protocol would have, you know, certain requirements in it, and if certain aspects of that protocol weren't followed, what, you know, what might happen, what could there be changes in the chemical nature of the urine test if, you know, certain things weren't followed, that kind of thing. Now, we don't know that much about Bosch. We do know that he apparently was the person who supplied substances to Manny Ramirez that led to Ramirez's suspension for 50 games in 2009. Maybe he had some information from Ramirez's situation that, you know, could have been relevant to Braun's situation. We just don't know. But, you know, a lot of people were saying, but guys, he's bogus. He wasn't a real doctor. He was slimy. People kind of knew, you know, you should stay away from him. You know, why would Braun, who's trying to clear his name, hire someone, you know, kind of, you know, why would he hire someone like that? And the example I gave in the Fangraphs article was, if you're a lawyer and you're representing someone accused of being in a conspiracy, a drug cartel conspiracy, you want to find out what it, you know, on the inside,
right.
You know, what a drug, you know, how a drug cartel works and how you might build a case that your client's actions are not consistent with either a particular cartel or cartels in general or cartels in, you know, some country. And, yeah, you might work with law enforcement consultants, but you might also work with people who'd formerly be in a drug cartel. I mean, it's just par for the course. It sounds a little unseemly, but that's kind of what lawyers have to do because legal cases often involve technical issues, issues beyond, you know, a lawyer's knowledge and issues that would be beyond a judge or a jury's knowledge. So, you know, I kind of laid out kind of how the legal process works and, you know, why Bosch would be someone that Braun's lawyers might want to talk to. And I also explained that if the amount that was owed was in the range of $20,000, that sounds like a lot of money, but it's actually not, you know, in the grand scheme of things, given how much was at issue for Braun and that his legal fees likely went over $1 million, just based on my experience, what it would have cost, you know, for the quality of lawyers he had and for the case that he had. So,
at that point, when somebody's trying to clear their name, $20,000 to $30,000 seems like a drop in the bucket, right?
Well, I mean, it's not an insignificant amount of money. It's also important to note that, at least as Yahoo reported it, there was a dispute over whether Braun's team owed Bosch $20,000. I mean, it was unclear whether Bosch thought he should be paid $20,000 to $30,000.
Right.
As opposed to Braun's team having agreed to pay him that. So that wouldn't surprise me either. I mean, plenty of times I work with consultants where you say, okay, well, we'll guarantee you $5,000. You'll do some preliminary work. The client will look at it, and maybe the client will decide they want to go forward with you or not. And then the, you know, consultant tries to make more out of it. I mean, that wouldn't surprise me either. So, you know, could you also read kind of everything that I've just said in a totally different light? Absolutely. My point was to say, you know, here are all the questions people were immediately raising on Twitter. You know, the guy's not a doctor. He's a slime ball. He was known not to, you know, he was known, you know, to have been already involved in unsavory activities involving Manny Ramirez. Wouldn't Braun hire, you know, kind of the best and the brightest, kind of all the things we've talked about. And I simply wrote to say, you know, you're making a lot of assumptions without kind of understanding how legal cases are put together. So this explanation seems entirely plausible to me. It could also be, you know, it could turn out, because there are documents we don't know about and other pieces of information we don't know about, that eventually the explanation will fall apart. But at least on its face, it seems entirely plausible.
To people that aren't.
That's kind of my point.
And I think you made it very well. And frankly, we live in a society where unless you're a member of the Baseball Writers Association of America, you're innocent until proven guilty.
Yes, well, those certainly are the rules here, you know, in our country. And I take your word for it. Those are the rules in Canada as well. You know, putting aside kind of the BBWA and the Hall of Fame vote, you know, that. You know, there are all within the collective bargaining agreement between the players and the owners in baseball, and specifically within the joint drug protocol, the joint drug policy, you know, it's very clear a positive test, regardless of how that substance got into your body, results in a 50-game suspension. But that's kind of all, you know, that's there has to be a positive drug test. The commissioner does. There is language suggesting the commissioner has some leeway, you know, to pursue a suspension through other means, but it's been used very infrequently. In fact, there were some folks that were referencing a situation involving Jordan Schaefer, who was at one point on the Braves and then was traded to the Astros and the Michael Bourne deal several years ago, and that he was suspended without a positive drug test, but I think he admitted to the infraction, and there the infraction, I think, was marijuana, not.
Yeah, that's right. That actually happened to somebody in the Blue Jays system as well this winter.
Right. So, yes, the commissioner has used kind of the catch-all language that's in the CBA to pursue suspensions, but not in a situation where a player is contesting the documents or contesting the evidence. You know, if Ryan Braun went to the mat over a positive test, you can imagine, you know, that he and his legal team would demand, you know, due process, you know, before the commissioner could be in a position to suspend him. And I'm sure other players would have the same position. So, you know, and it's very interesting what's happening now. Major League Baseball sent some very significant senior officers down to Miami to meet with the Miami New Times editorial staff to see if they could get them to share the documents. And to date, that newspaper hasn't agreed to do that, which, you know, I give them a lot of credit for that, and I also think it's the right call. You know, their job, how many anonymous sources, how many other sources are going to come forward in whatever, you know, whatever other investigations they're doing, if those sources are just going to be turned over to, you know, the corporation, maybe, you know, a former employer of a source, or maybe the person is a whistleblower. I mean, there's lots of very thorny kind of, you know, journalism ethics issues that are involved.
Yeah.
And they get even thornier when the government comes calling. So, you know, kind of where this is going to go from here is very interesting, you know, because so far, Miami Times has some documents, Yahoo has documents. There hasn't been a lot said about whether Yahoo has been asked to turn over documents to Major League Baseball or has agreed to do that. We don't know who the source is. We don't know if it's more than one source. You know, there are a lot of unanswered questions, and unless Major League Baseball gets some cooperation from somebody, You know, it remains to be seen how far this will go.
We're finishing up with baseball writer Wendy Thurm. She's in San Francisco, and you can follow her on Twitter at Hanging Sliders. Wendy, refresh my memory. You got a new baseball gig this week, didn't you?
Yes. So I'm still going to be writing at Fangraphs. I'm going to be back with the guys at
Getting Blanked.
Getting Blanked on the Score. I'm also going to be writing a bit more about the Giants, in particular for Bay Area folks, for a website called BayAreaSportsDie.com. A friend of mine, Steve Berman, runs that site. He's been doing it for 4 or 5 years. He covers kind of the panoply of Bay Area professional sports, and he wants to have, you know, a bit more of a, maybe a stats focus, more of a kind of a big picture focus for the Giants. So I'm going to be probably 3 to 4 times a month writing stories, kind of, you know, when big things are happening with the Giants. So I was, I did participate in Media Day last Friday and had an opportunity to talk with, I don't know, 8 or 10 players one-on-one, and it was delightful. And I actually had a really nice conversation with Lindsey Cunningham. He has a haircut, but, you know, he seems quite focused, and I think it's going to be a very interesting year for him.
Are you planning on being in San Fran for the World Baseball Classic?
I'm going to be in Arizona for the World Baseball Classic. I mean, I happen to be there. I'll be at a Sabre conference, and then I have some Fangraph stuff going on and some games, and I think there's WBC action there, and I don't know if I get back in time for the finals here. I will say, though, the tickets are quite expensive.
Well, I've got a beat on one for myself, and I'm trying to figure out if I can find a flight at a reasonable price. If so, I'm going to head down for it, and if you're there, I would love to meet you.
That would be fantastic, yeah. I think the finals, are they not like the 18th and 19th? I think I am just back from Arizona when the finals.
I think that's it. I think it's 17th, 18th, 19th are the two semis, right, and then the final.
Right. Have you experienced 18-team park before?
I have not experienced California.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I'll certainly will be your tour guide. I'd be delighted.
Amazing. Wendy Thurm from Fangraphs, from Bay Area Sports Guy, from Getting Blanked. Follow her on Twitter at Hanging Sliders. Thank you so much for clarifying that for us tonight.
No worries at all.
Speak to you soon.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. There she goes. Jimmy, play us a song. This is The Kaufman Show. We'll be back. We'll take your calls. 514-790-1690, 1-866-896-2546. Boy, we've been playing a lot of Hip and R. Kelce tonight. Why? Going to see him on Thursday. I can't wait. Can't wait. Don't tisk me, Jay Farrar. That sounds like a rabbit chewing on the microphone.
Like a Grabowski.
A Grabowski. Always fun to come in on some isotopes. That is the first day of spring training, and we're going to bring in Evan Wansbrough, the lead singer of the Isotopes. He is a hopeful for the MLB Fan Cave, and we had him on last week. We're going to bring him on one more time so he can sell himself to you, ladies and gentlemen. The vote, boy, that vote ends soon. Evan, when does that vote end?
That vote ends on the 13th. So that's Wednesday.
That is Wednesday, and I know you're still Monday because you're out west, but we're already Tuesday, man. You're talking
to
tomorrow here.
Down there.
Yeah,
you down to it.
You'd better convince my audience, which is Montreal and all points east, west, north, and south. Tell them where to go, tell them what to do, and tell them why to vote for you.
Well, right now there's a fan vote, and that's part of it. So you can go to MLB.com/fancave and find me. It's Evan Wansbro. You can also tweet at the Isotopes. And throw on at MLB Fan Cave while you're tweeting there, too, because I know that that's making a big difference. We've had a lot of Twitter support, and those guys are paying attention to that pretty closely. And, I assume you have a big Montreal Expos Nation in your listenership out there. And,
yeah,
and,
pander to them quickly, because people hear Blue Jays fan, and they get all scared.
Yeah, I thought about that, you know, and... I think the most important thing is that... If they're taking a Canadian into the fan cave, and I think that they want to, and I think that they ought to, it's that someone who can represent the country, and maybe not present the absolute stereotypes that the Americans already have of us, and I think that's where one of my strong suits is I can go in and I can represent, you know, for the most part, I can represent the baseball fans nationwide. Blue Jays, Expos, whomever. And that's what I'm aiming to do when I go in.
Well, here's some good news for you. Coming in on Twitter right now from Dan K. MTL. Anyone with a Simpsons reference and a Kaufman endorsement has got my vote already.
Boom, Dan K. Okay, expect a retweet later, man. Thanks very much.
Evan, we wish you the best of luck, and hopefully we'll speak this time next week, and you'll have made it into the fan cave or into the top 30.
Great. Thanks so much, Dave. Appreciate it.
No worries. I'm going to go home and vote like 20 times for you, I promise.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Let's play him off on some more Isotopes. That is Evan Wansbrough. And you know what? If he doesn't make it, we're going to see him in Montreal in May. I'm dying to see this band in concert. This is going to be a fun show. But hopefully, Jay, we can go down to Broadway and 4th and see them rock out in the fan cave.
Wow. Yeah. I'd like to go down. Man.
Go to MLB.com. MLBFanCave.com, pardon me. I don't think he's in the majors yet. It's MLBFanCave.com. Find Evan's video and vote for him. Vote early, vote often. You got a little over 24 hours. You're listening to The Kaufman Show. We'll be back for one more segment, and we'll make it count. Brought to our attention that we have not said the H word yet tonight. We've actually said the word Leafs more than the word Habs tonight on the Kaufman Show. That's messed up, man.
Well, that's what happens when you have a game like Saturday's.
I guess. And, well, I don't know. I mean, the fact that they're out of town and they're off to Florida for the next couple of days. And
That's a good thing, I think.
I think so, too.
I think they're happy to go to Florida. I'd be wanting to go to Florida, too, after Saturday night's debacle.
We will talk a little bit of hockey, though, right now. Last week, my dearly talented, wonderful, amazing co-host hooked us up with Ross Rebliati and Dick Pound, who are part of this conference at the Omni Hotel that's was today and is tomorrow and probably is going to be a little too early for me to get to tomorrow, Mr. Farrar.
Mm-hmm.
Just full disclosure.
Okay.
Probably won't be making it in the morning.
Okay.
But one of the speakers who we didn't get to last week, we spoke to tonight, and it's her name is Danielle Sauvageau, one of the pioneers of Canadian women's hockey.
Yep.
And
a cop.
And yeah. a narc.
And a narc at that.
Yeah. And, you know.
An active narc.
Jay and I have a lot of experience with narcs.
Yeah.
And, well, I mean, we've both been to a lot of concerts growing up.
Yes. That's why.
We figured it would be a suitable interview to discuss the state of affairs in international hockey and women's hockey and Sochi being a year away. And, okay, no, I'm lying. Honestly, we arranged this interview with Danielle Sauvageau, and I really appreciated that Jay did. And then we were like, what are we going to talk to her about?
Right.
I mean, the Olympics are a year away. What are we going to do? But you know what? We did it, and it was quite a good conversation. And here it is.
She can hold her own.
Damn straight.
One of the biggest concerns coming out of the Vancouver Olympics was the disparity between Canada, the U.S., and all the other nations. How is that being addressed?
Well, this is one of the concerns, but of course, I mean, it's hard to compare USA. Well, we always compare us to USA because we're kind of, we share the same border, but obviously we don't have the same sports system, we don't have the same population, we don't have the same college and university level system. So obviously we need to continue to say, okay, this is what Canada has been doing and how could we address things? And we have the Sport Institute, like in here in Montreal especially, we're going to have our new institute in less than a year from now. So that's going to help like the athlete to be more supported in the sense that they will have a integrated system around them in order to not only to be well supported in medical area, nutrition area, biomechanics, physiology. So this is where Canada has moved forward since Vancouver mostly. But then again, if we keep talking about the money, we're always going to keep talking about it because obviously we cannot compare ourselves to the States.
No, but all this training and all of this, won't this continue to make the gap between Canada and let's say the European nations or the Scandinavian countries or Russia? There seems to be such a difference in the way and the amount that they allocate towards women's hockey versus men's hockey.
Well, for sure. I mean, when for women's hockey, I mean, it's still like a women's sport. And I mean, in some countries, they're still struggling to get some funding on the women's side. So obviously, if we talk about women's hockey especially, there are some countries that are still struggling about getting funding to men's hockey. So obviously, the women are far behind. But we need to continue to the IIHF, the International Ice Hockey Federation, with Hockey Canada, actually put a program together, a pilot program, actually, leading up to Sochi to help the other country, the best, well, I'm going to talk about the best 14 countries in order to help them to get to the next level worldwide. So, yes, we think that we could bridge the gap, but then again, Canada continue to invest in women's hockey, too, so we're probably going to still keep, you know, still bridge or keep that gap for years to come. But we have to remember that it took about 60 years for the Swedish team, for example, on the men's side to beat Canada at the Olympics. So I don't believe it's going to take 60 years for a country to beat Canada at the Olympics. But we need to continue to improve hockey here in North America. And hopefully some other country will continue to send their players here to train. Like, for example, with the Montreal University with the Carabin, we had four French players actually playing for our team this year, and this is part of the international program to have them coming here and then go back to their country better than if they were at the beginning of the year, and hopefully they're going to continue to send us players.
which, you know, Canada, I think, has a responsibility to help make the rest of the world better at this in order to grow the game, right?
Well, yes, it is a responsibility, but I think it's a wish. It's a will. I mean, if you talk to Bob Nicholson, he's going to say, yes, we want to be part of it, even if that maybe in 20 or 25 years from now, they're going to come and haunt us. But we want to export our sport, and we want them to continue to be better. And it's by sharing coaching knowledge, but also Team France, for example, remind me where we were 25 years ago. So hopefully, based on what we've done in Canada, it's not going to take Team France 25 years to get to where Canada is today. So yes, it is a responsibility because we want to grow the game globally, and it's our role as well.
Canada continues to grow leaps and bounds, and the world is attempting to catch up at the same time, which must be difficult. I wonder, and you were the head coach of the 2002 gold medal winning team. Now, how would that team compare to the 2010 gold medal winning team?
But I always say that the 2010 Olympic team had the best team ever. And I wish I'm going to say the same thing in 2014, saying that 2014, this is the best team that Canada put together. And that's normal, because if we continue to grow the game, especially at the younger age, kids today, it's normal to see little girls playing hockey at the age of 5 or 6 years old, as in 2002 or 2000, early 2000, we didn't see that across the country. So, yes, the team is better. The structure is better. And we need to continue to be better as coaches and also as support staff. So I want to believe that the 2014 team will be better than 2010.
Wrapping up with Danielle Sauvageau. Danielle, I would say that you're probably the second most famous police officer turned hockey coach after Pat Burns. Is there anything that you learned from him, or did you guys ever have a relationship, and were you able to compare the similarities and differences?
Well, I think that Pat was in policing for less than 10 years, and I've been a police officer for 28 years. And I remember way back when, I think we met for the first time in 2003 or 2004, and I teased him about it. I said, well, first of all, I have more experience as a police officer than you, so you have to respect me. And then he turned around and says, yes, but I've been a coach for many, many more years than you. And I said, well, I would not bet on that either. So we used to kind of tease each other, because obviously I've been coaching since I'm the age, I'm 15 years old. So, but I didn't have, I would not say that I had a relationship with him, that every time we had the opportunity and privilege to see each other, like in an event or something like that, it was kind of fun to, I felt like we knew each other because of our background. But I didn't have the privilege to be in his very kind of close friends, I should say.
Danielle, will you join us again on the show a little closer to the Olympics to break down?
For sure. And I would like to remind you that there's also a World coming up in Ottawa in less than 6 or 7 weeks ago, the first week of April. We received the World here in Canada in Ottawa, and obviously Canada wants to finish the tournament with the gold medal. So there's a few things in the meantime, between now and the Olympics. So anytime, feel free to call us.
Well, not only did you remind me, but you enlightened me. I had no idea, and I feel bad about it. And I thank you, and I promise you that we will devote some time to it on the show and definitely speak with you again sometime in the next couple of months.
Well, there you go.
Merci beaucoup. Thank you so much for your time tonight.
Okay, good night.
Have a great night.
Dashboard taken years ago, turned around backwards so the windshield shows every street light.
Jay, I'm in one of those moods where I feel like we could keep talking for hours.
Yeah?
Maybe it's because we pre-taped so much of it.
Because we haven't been saying anything,
exactly,
that's why.
Exactly. We'll come back, we'll do one more segment, see if the regulars give us a show.
Is that REM?
It is.
Are they still around?
No, they're not.
Oh, okay.
They broke up.
They're still in their REM stage?
One of my favorite REM songs off from Automatic. It's off, I think it's the Zone Automatic for the People.
Don't look at me. I don't know a damn thing about REM.
Night Swimming.
Night Swimming deserves a quiet night. I'm not sure all these people understand. It's not like years ago. Fear of getting caught. The recklessness of water. They cannot see me naked. These things, they go away. Replaced by every day. Night swimming. Remembering that night. September's coming soon. Pining for the moon. What if there were two? Side by side in orbit around the fairest sun. That bright tide forever drum could not describe night swimming. You, I thought I knew you. You, I.
This is the Kaufman Show. John Kakalakis coming up with a sports update. We'll be back for a little bit more fun.
You don't knock,
just walk on in
the door. Walk on in.
Welcome back, Detroit Cobras. Where have you been? It's been so long.
I haven't heard that one in a long time.
I know. It's, but you know what, Jay? We were sick of it when we retired it, and it was nice to hear it just now.
Yes, it was.
I feel like you're lying. You know, one night, Jay, I'm just going to surprise you and call you at like 4 o'clock in the afternoon and say, you know what, dude? You pick the music tonight.
Oh, I don't think you want me to do that, Dave.
Why?
What? Oh, okay.
Why not?
Yeah.
One day. I give you my word.
One day we'll have J-Music Day.
J-Tunes. Day, yes.
J-Tunes.
Which will be all like suicidal tendencies and Public Enemy, right?
There'll be, yeah, I would put, yeah, suicidal, Public Enemy, a little Wu-Tang. You know, I'll throw in some...
You better get here early that day to work in all the bleeps for the Wu-Tang songs.
Yeah, well, no, there. I know. All
oh,
the,
you're not going to play Gravel Pit. Come on, you gotta. You know.
No. You got to play the real stuff. Right. But you know, I know all the songs and I know most of their opening verses. So I'll be able to know which ones are swearing and which ones are not, and when Jimmy has to cut it off in a panic.
Yeah, every once in a while, I tell Jimmy, like, you got 4 seconds before.
Yeah.
Mick Jagger says something that we aren't allowed to say on air.
Yeah, but when I hosted the show in your absence,
yes,
you know, I had some. I had some Marvin Gaye. I had some Luciano Pavarotti.
I was going to say, I remember some, the opera. That
yes,
cool.
You got to put it all over the place. I love many genres of music, not only the alternative and hard stuff.
Well, I like a few different genres. I don't know about many, but I like a few.
Yes.
You'll hear us playing a little bit of folk music.
Mm-hmm.
I play hip-hop on the show every once in a while, but you call it white guy hip-hop.
White guy hip-hop, yeah. Which is nothing wrong with that.
I am what I am.
Two of the greatest rappers of all time yesterday did a whole tribute to white rappers, you know?
Jewish white rappers.
Jewish white rappers, no less. And, of course, got cut off in the middle of it for a Delta commercial. And,
well, they love to fly. And, shows.
And an explanation of how they give out the awards. Chuck D, in 25 years, still cannot get any airtime. The man is still bringing him down.
No respect.
No respect. No respect.
No regard either.
Yeah. Can't even get into the Hall of Fame without everybody bitching about it either. Unbelievable.
We're going to do one more segment. And, you know, we always throw a last call and... Jay is all about the last call, Daniel Salvis.
Ladies and gentlemen, last call for alcohol. Mesdames et messieurs, Daniel Salvis, last call.
And it's one of those beautiful last calls where we can actually call last call on the radio and still make last call at the bar.
Yes.
So
yes, we can.
Depending on how many calls we get right now, 514-790-1690. If you're out of town, 1-866-896-2546. And let's go out of town. Let's go to Travis in Asheville, North Carolina. Good evening, sir. How are you?
You know, I better than Saturday night, I'll tell you that much. Wow.
Yeah, that one, I'll be honest with you. I knew where it was going and stopped paying attention. And do you care that much?
You know, I don't care about the loss. What it made me think, though, I remember thinking at the time, I made a conscious effort. I didn't look at Twitter for 2 days after that.
Oh, really?
I didn't want to see it. I didn't want to see it because I had the thought in my head was, I've never been happier to be a fan of a baseball team that doesn't exist. Watch what was happening on Twitter after that game.
That's funny you say that, because during the game, somebody at the pub yelled out, "Where are the Expos when we need them?" A guy who I never thought would say something like that, which was good.
That's funny. Well, yeah, because of course, if in back in the olden days, if the Habs had taken a 6-0 shellacking in the middle of February, everybody would be like, "Well, pitchers and catchers in 2 weeks, it's
yeah,
all good.
Starting tomorrow." Yeah, false hope, but still.
So, what's going on, Travis?
Well, not long for this place, which is nice. Enjoying that thought, you know, getting closer to the motherland.
Oh yeah, that's right. You're moving back up towards Canada, aren't you?
He's leaving NSC.
He's leaving Asheville, NSC, and he's going to Attsburg,
Attsburg, New York.
That joke doesn't work.
New York.
It doesn't work as well, no.
No.
But you are moving to Plattsburgh, which is great news for us, because it means we'll, whenever there's a TSN 690 function, you'll be able to head up the road, right?
Oh, indeed. And maybe I'll get that. I'll get George to give me that gift certificate final I gave him.
I'm sorry?
Oh, like a year ago, I got a gift certificate from Fruitopia for being the best call. And I said, give it to George.
Oh, well, perfect.
Well, that's gone. Believe me.
I'll pick that up with George.
That's in a filing cabinet in the offices of Fruitopia right now,
yeah,
believe me.
That's probably expired, but I will gladly buy you a beer at Fruitopia.
Don't worry. It's not for financial reasons. But
No. Emotional ones, please. Come on.
Yeah. Plus, it's just... It's you know, I don't want to diverge you too far from sports into politics, but not so great down here these days. Let me tell you.
Well, you want to elaborate a little?
Well, it's the mood, it's the attitude, you know, it is kind of like the Twitter internet tribalism with teams and with the media. Just extend it instead of, you know, no matter how important the hockey is. It is still just a game. You take it away from teams and games into policy that affects the livelihood and life of people. It gets kind of unfortunate. And I know that's everywhere. It's not only in the South, but it gets pretty weird down here.
State of the Union is tomorrow, right?
Yes, and the president will actually be in my town not too long after.
Really?
Yes.
Is that the kind of thing where you can line up and go see him speak or no?
No, I'm pretty sure those tickets have already been closed.
Okay. State of the Union speeches always fascinate me. It's a good example of that kind of city on the hill type thing that America's good at, which is laying out what they want to do versus what they can do.
Well, we certainly are Aquinian in that respect.
Everything's just a big damn Springsteen.
There's a lot of standing ovations that happen after every sentence.
Only half the crowd, though.
Only half, yes.
Yeah, or standing up and shouting, "You lie."
Oh, my God, I forgot about that idiot. Yeah, you lie. Wow.
Well, he's the president. He does lie. They all lie. I mean, you know, he's not wrong.
Yeah, but there's a time and a place to say it.
Yeah, I know. State of the Union. But, I mean, what's the hypocrisy here? At least somebody's yelling out something. Like we said, half the crowd is standing up, giving a standing ovation. The other is just sitting there, mostly politely. So, you know, it must be such a strange social setting, isn't it? Just so awkward, you know? Anyway.
I'd imagine so.
Yeah.
Well, no State of the Union speech quite as riveting as Kevin Kline's and Dave, I'd say.
Oh, no. But, that is, you know, hence is America, though. We, you know, it's the sort of, it's the grand experiment, and it's idealized and portrayed in a manner, even when it's portrayed in a way that is, you know, by definition, indicting the system. It still likes to betray it. It still likes to portray itself as having that shred of idealism. And despite how many times it's kicked and punched and put in the gutter and you realize it's not going to work out right, you still have that glimmer of hope waiting to be crushed yet again that will get it right.
That's the beauty of it all, right?
Yeah.
That's what keeps people coming back for more. And that's what made The West Wing such a successful television program.
Yeah, well, The West Wing is legendary.
Yeah, but unfortunately it's not real. I mean, as much as I want President Bartlett on Twitter to actually be someone, it's sort of like sort of like following Will McAvoy, right? It's
a little bit.
It's all wishful thinking. So, Travis, when is moving day?
I don't know the exact date, but it will be up here. I will be up there by Canada Day, which is also my birthday.
Oh, good stuff, man. Oh, well, I'll tell you, man. Really looking forward to meeting you.
Indeed.
Have yourself a great evening.
You as well.
We will.
Cheers.
Bye bye. So formal at the end there, Jay.
Yes, it was very nice.
It was very, very, very
yes,
formal.
You guys broke my heart. Very nice.
Broke your heart.
Very polite.
Well, I didn't know that being polite breaks your heart.
It gave me shivers, a lump in my throat.
Well,
it did nothing for me.
Okay, good. That's.
I'm glad he's not overreacting too much about the Canadians, because I've heard a lot about that this week. And
there was a lot of weirdness. I mean,
growing pains, people. Growing pains.
Yeah.
You know. I mean, you're not going to win the Stanley Cup. The problem is, it was, I guess, a bit of a tease.
They go on a run, and then everybody gets excited. But it's, and I mean, you heard it across the board. I don't think there was anybody that thought that the Habs were going to lose to Toronto on Saturday. They were so confident.
No. It seems that the fans were a little bit more prepared and hyped up for it than the team seemed to be.
Yeah.
But you know what? There are going to be days like that. It's going to happen. Right now, Toronto seems to have Montreal's number, but, you know, they're not a bad team.
Wasn't that the third game in 4 days?
Yeah, but Toronto as well. I mean, it does say up in the locker room, no excuses, doesn't it?
Oh, right. Okay, well, if it says that, then I guess there aren't any excuses.
No. Everybody's got to relax. Chill out. Is that what Carey Price said? Chill out.
Years ago in the exhibition season.
Yeah. It's going to take time, people. You've got a 1 out of 30 chance of winning the Stanley Cup. It's going to take time.
It was interesting, Jay, for us to be able to air an episode from a year ago on the radio tonight.
Mm-hmm.
And hear the difference, sort of, between then and now.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I kept going back to in that episode from a year ago was the promise that we're going to continue to talk about baseball and that we'll continue to keep it top of mind. And I think we've done that in the last year.
Yes.
I think we've done a very good job of that. We had a show tonight with 5 guests, and 4 of them were baseball related.
Right.
It's the middle of February, and mm-hmm. the Habs are playing. We still don't have a baseball team in this town. But for those of you who give a damn, every Monday night, we're here, we're talking. We're talking all sorts of stuff.
Did my voice sound different?
From last year? Mine did.
Yeah?
Mine did, yeah.
You've grown older?
Well, I was also really emotional that night.
I was so much older then. I'm younger than that now.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you, Bob. I don't even know what to say to that.
Yeah. What are you doing? Are you playing something?
No, I'm just, surfing.
Oh, okay.
Checking my email.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah, you know what? Okay, I will go ahead.
Jimmy, play some Suicidal.
No.
While he's distracted.
No, I'll tell you straight up what I'm distracted
okay.
about.
Okay.
Somebody posted a rant on Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
And Jay and I have since discovered that it's an urban legend. But it's a friend of mine put up a rant from Bill Cosby. It's, mm-hmm. it's got a picture of Bill Cosby, and it starts off, "I'm 83 and tired." And it's vile. And it's basically a big, long spewing of hatred.
Yes.
And I looked at it, and right away I wrote, where's this quote from? I find it hard to believe that Bill Cosby wrote this.
Mm-hmm.
And then intrepid journalist Jay Farrar did a little bit of digging and found the actual quote from Bill Cosby's website that says, there's an email floating around entitled, I'm 76 and tired, purportedly sent by me. I did not write the email. I did not send the email. I'm not 76. I don't subscribe to the ugly views expressed on the email. We are coming up to an important anniversary. This is obviously around 9/11, a day where we should all come together. Whoever wrote this email is not thinking about our country or what is important. If you get the email, it's time to hit delete. Source, BillCosby.com.
Right.
And it kind of goes back a bit to what we were talking about with Wendy and you know, attributing the right thing to the right person. And, you know, when somebody is suspected of something, maybe using the word allegedly instead of, you know, nailing them to the cross right away.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, so that's where my mind just went. I try to be a responsible, not just journalist, but human being.
Well, that's the danger with all the social media these days. You're going to get things like that.
It's a huge danger. And it's, I mean, but it happens in the media as well. And mm-hmm. it's something that I think we work on to, that we strive for, to do better than that.
Yeah. And when, you know, people, when you see something like that, especially something that's ugly, and it's attributed to somebody who's, well, you know what? Bill Cosby has said some stupid things in his time, but never to that degree.
No.
You know, I mean, that is just vile, the things that were coming out of his mouth.
We're not even repeating it.
But we're not even going to repeat it. It's garbage. It's garbage anyway. We can't repeat it because it's not Bill Cosby saying it.
Right.
And that's the point, right? That's the point.
Pretty much.
Just because you put a guy's picture on some stupid quote doesn't mean he said it. So, you know, do your homework, do your research, make sure before you start spreading this stuff all over the internet. It's a waste of time.
So Jay and I interview Kimmy Carter tonight, and we speak to her for about a half an hour, maybe 40 minutes probably, eh?
Yes.
It was a long conversation.
We have the director's cut available for listening.
We have the director's cut.
Yes.
I'm not sure. I think we're going to put up the one that we just put up now.
Okay.
Because the director's cut has things like...
we have to release it later.
Exactly.
Because we have to add in the CG effects.
Well, exactly.
Yes.
Well, in like
special edition.
5 or 6 months, there will be the...
the Blu-ray.
Kimmy Carter Redux.
Yeah, exactly.
And... afterwards, we interviewed Daniel Sauvageau, and it was pretty much one after the other. I think we spoke with Kimmy from 6 to 6:40, and then we called Sauvageau right away. And while we were interviewing Sauvageau, I get an email from Kimmy saying, there's more that I want to say.
Mm-hmm.
One day we'll play it.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that was nice of her. I was, like I said, I appreciate how candid she was and how, you know, honest and positive.
Yeah,
that she was. You know, never for a moment did you feel that she was sad. She seems to be rejoicing and remembering in a very fond way the life of her dad.
Such an honor that she decided to share her memories of her father with us.
Absolutely. Yeah, it really is.
And a year later, we still all miss Gary Carter. And we thank him for everything that he did for our city.
Hear, hear.
Jimmy. Play us some Joel Plaskett. Night, everyone.
Listen up, kid. It's not what you think. Stayed out too late. Had a little too much to drink. Walk home across the bridge. When the marquee shut down, there's a reason that I love this town. Nobody cares how much money you have. If you've got enough to get in a cab, there'll be drinks on the house. If your house burns down, there's a reason that I love this town. I saw your band shot the shit with miniature Tim. If he needs a tune, then write one for him. We like the same books and we like the same sounds. There's a reason that I love this town. I played a show in Kelowna last year. Said, pick it up, Joel. We're dying in here. Picture one hand clapping, then picture half that sound. There's a reason that I hate that town. If you saw my band in the early days, then you understand why we moved away. We hold a grudge anyway, because it's fun. Face down in our suit, some French restaurant. I saw Rivière du Loup last night at a tour. We burnt the place to the ground. There's a reason that I love this town. There's a reason that I love this town. There's a reason that I love this town.
You've been listening to The Kaufman Show. For Jay Farrar, I'm Dave Kaufman. And we'll be back next week.
I don't know. What'd that sound like?